It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
I started law school in 1993. And it was about that time that Court TV came into being. And of course, I'm going to law classes all day. And I'm living the law. It's all I'm talking about. It's all I'm thinking about. I'm fascinated by it. And that was a time when pop culture was becoming obsessed with trials. You'll remember it wasn't much after that that we had the O.J. Simpson trial. And the nation was riveted by that. In fact, I'm 51. For my generation, you still remember the name of the judge. You still remember Marsha Clark, Judge Ito, Chris Darden. Of course, that's when the world came to know of the first Kardashian, from which this whole spawn was unleashed on America. That's where a lot of folks first heard of F. Lee Bailey, although he was pretty well known. Johnny Cochran became a national name. You think of all the lines from that, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Those guys had lived their entire careers, and they became nationally famous after that because the nation was all of a sudden obsessed with the trial and with trial attorneys, and everybody became kind of amateur court observers. Court TV came out, and it started showing, you know, trials. And Nancy Grace's awful show became, you know, what was the girl that was down in Aruba? Natalie Holloway, yep. And the cheerleader moms. And so trials became this sort of national shared experience. Follow me here. Trials became a way that we could look at facts and things that happened and the defendant, because these were all criminal trials, and it could be something that we shared. It became programming. Now, this is about the time that reality TV was coming into being, but this was reality TV with the highest of stakes. This was reality TV marrying To Kill a Mockingbird and Matlock and Law and Order. This was an interesting time in America, and I think we went through a period where real life trials, we burned out on that. And the Rittenhouse trial, the young man in Wisconsin who was adjudged not guilty, that really gave America a return. It whet the appetite for that again. I know a lot of people that do what I do in some form or another, commentators, observers and commentators. A lot of folks on the social media sites, particularly Twitter, that are writers and podcasters, became obsessed with this trial. And they know every... I didn't even have to follow it because you would get updates constantly from these people. And so with that in mind, if the Rittenhouse trial was worthy of so much attention and so much ink and so much video time for TV stations, because this was really Trump's white supremacist America on trial, then why on earth hasn't anybody talked about two far more important trials that are going on now? I don't know what percentage of you don't even know these trials are being held. One of them is the enabler of Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine, I don't know how a damn woman's name is pronounced. There's an S that's silent. In French or not, that's weird. But Jeffrey Epstein's procurer, the woman who was getting these women that he was sexually assaulting, the woman who had all these relations with Clinton, the woman who was there on Orgy Island, that trial. And then there's the race hoax and the crime hoax and the white supremacist MAGA hoax. Jussie Smollett. Remember him? We've had all these hoax cases. I think LeBron was one of them, frankly, but we don't know that for sure. The N-word was supposedly spray-painted across his garage door, but by the time the cops arrived, it had been painted over. Huh. Oddly enough, it's hoax after hoax after hoax. It's Rolling Stone magazine and the Virginia fraternity hoax. It's the Duke lacrosse case hoax. It's Tawana Brawley. These hoaxes are worthy of our attention because Jussie Smollett, well, we're going to get into that. We're going to get into those two trials. But first, let's go back and remember the Jussie Smollett story. This is a guy who's on a television show, which apparently was very popular. I've never seen it. You may have, called Empire. And he has a tangential role, I'm told, or it's been reported, and he's about to be let go from the show. And in order to gin up public sympathy for himself, he claims, as he's going for a 2 a.m. footlong to Subway or somewhere in the freezing cold of Chicago and downtown, that two white men wearing MAGA hats came up and beat him and put a noose around his neck and were calling him the N-word and threatening to kill him. Well, everyone knows he made that up now. But you need a primer on Jussie Smollett because you might have forgotten.
I'm bored. I wish I could be a famous actor.
Now you can, with the Jussie Smollett Hoax Kit, of course. It's easy. Every Jussie Smollett Hoax Kit comes with everything you need to trick the media into believing you're a victim.
Oh, neat! Two MAGA hats, a noose, and a bottle of bleach!
And don't forget the Subway sandwich!
But what do I do if right-wing news outlets get suspicious of my scheme?
First, throw away your burner phone. Then, use the business card found inside every hoax kit to call a really good lawyer.
How convenient!
So get your Jussie Smollett hoax kit today, kids! Just steal the credit card out of your mom's purse to order online and then lie and say it wasn't you later on when your mom asks what happened!
Just like Jussie Smollett!
So, this case is a great opportunity to explore something that is a pandemic in this country. It's an epidemic in this country. And that is people claiming they were the victim of racist violence when in fact they weren't. Why is it happening so often? Why do people, if Jussie Smollett was trying to save his job, there are a number of different things he could have claimed happened to him. Why was this the one he chose? Open the trial up and let us see. Why have you closed it off? Why did Kamala Harris rush to his defense immediately? Why was it so important to her as a presidential candidate at that time to be seen taking his side before the facts had emerged? Why was it so important that Good Morning America have him on to share his story? Why did it have to be a white supremacist, MAGA, Trump-wearing assailant instead of just that someone black did it, which was actually, considering he was in Chicago, where they would have fit in more, and in fact, that's the people he paid to do it. You see, this is a deep exploration. These hoaxes are something bigger than the hoax. They tell you a lot. Well, we'll get to that.
Backing the blue and our vets too. It's the Michael Berry Show.
I bought a toothbrush, some toothpaste, a flannel for my face, pajamas, a hairbrush, new shoes, and a case. I said to my reflection, let's get out
Germany,
of this place.
Before we get to the Ghislaine Maxwell case, and I realize I'm probably not saying her name right. I don't say Jen Psaki's name right either, and I don't really care. If it bothers you, then just pretend I said it correctly. If you're going to put that many consonants together and have to swallow half of them, then it's not really my phonetic pattern or cultural background. There is a German Euthanasia Association. That's not young people in Tokyo. That is killing yourself. There's a German euthanasia association called Verein Sterbehilfe. Hope I pronounced that correctly. They help people kill themselves. It's true. It's a true story. And now, you can't make this stuff up. Now they have declared that they won't help anyone kill themselves unless they're vaccinated. What's the reason to be vaccinated? Supposedly, although I don't buy this, supposedly being vaccinated keeps you from getting the virus, which is not true. We now know. But what would it matter if you got the virus and died from it if you're killing yourself anyway? You honestly can't make this stuff up. You honestly cannot make this stuff up. Yeah, they will know. They will. A suicide factory, which is what they're called, what they're referred to as, a euthanasia association that helps people kill themselves, will not help people kill themselves if they're not vaccinated.
And now a message from the German Euthanasia Association, a.k.a. a suicide clinic.
Hello, and Merry Christmas out there to everyone who plans to kill themselves this holiday season. As you know, suicide is a very normal and healthy thing. It's perfectly okay to kill yourself. Everyone agrees. Suicide is an easy solution to some of life's most complicated problems with virtually no negative consequences. But as simple and easy as suicide may be, one thing that is not simple and easy is avoiding being vaccinated. We have had many of our victims, patients, ask us, do I need to be vaccinated to kill myself? The answer is yes, absolutely. You wouldn't want to die of COVID while you're trying to kill yourself, would you? As you know, the health and well-being of our patients is of the most utmost importance to us here at the German Death Chamber Association. The German Euthanasia Association. And we care about your health. We want you to be as healthy as possible while you're committing suicide. So please, from all of us here at your favorite suicide assistance organization, remember to get vaccinated. Because nobody wants to die of COVID if they're trying to die from something else. Thank you.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
Yeah. It's a crazy, crazy world. Coming up next, by the way, I'm going to talk to Alex Berenson, and I will tell you, Alex Berenson is one of the guys that has become a superstar out of the mania of the last year and a half. What he has done reporting on COVID, he has a new book that hit today, and he's going to be our guest coming up. He has been the most fearless and effective writer, thinker, talker on the issue of COVID and pushing back. He was a New York Times reporter, very well respected, and the journalism industry has turned their back on him and really slandered him because he came from their ranks and he started saying, hey guys, we're not journalists anymore. What we're doing is not right. We've got to report the facts. And he's written a book called Pandemia, about the hysteria of COVID. It hit today. I haven't read it, but I encourage you to buy it. It's going to be really, 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 really good and insightful because I read his stuff every day, and he has been on top of all of this. Anyway, so why isn't Miss Maxwell and her trial, why did they close that off to the media? Jeffrey Epstein ran in the circles of Bill Gates and Bill Clinton. Orgy Island, what they were up to, what happened there, we need to know. She was part of it, but the top ranks of American power was flying on Jeffrey Epstein's jet and having sex with underage girls, and they're closing that off to the public? No. We need to know what happened, far more than what happened in the Rittenhouse trial. A couple of goober white liberals trying to kill some guy who's just keeping a building from burning down. Oh, we got every minute of that. But this? Anyway.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a rapist trip that started with a president and a Democrat fellowship. His mates were child-molesting men. The strippers did their chores. Old bastards on a sexcapade with 13-year-old whores. 13-year-old whores. Castrate that motherfucker. Bill Clinton started getting rough. The fresh salad was tossed. There's a cover-up by the media. The story has been lost. The internet's been washed. Bill flew in on a private jet to visit Orgy Isle. The narrative, that's right-wing conspiracy, says Bill rapey rape and his dyke. And all the movie stars, all the idiots on the internet, everybody is in denial. Bill went on a raping holiday and he had a real good time. He said it was just a one-time thing, but he went back 25 times. The sex slaves did what they could do. They tried their very best. They stuffed their bras with a Kleenex box to bolster up their chest. But wait, there's a little problem now. It's an inconvenient truth. Anonymous has a video recorded by the Jews. They've got his ass on video. Bill plays the pedophile. He was raping underage sex slaves there on Orgy Isle.
It's amazing how many things we forget about that at the time were a big deal. In his mansion, Jeffrey Epstein had a painting of Bill Clinton sprawled across a chaise lounge in a blue dress with red high heels. What are you doing, you weirdo? That's your kink? When you say we all have our kinks, that suggests in some weird way that this is normal. Yes, I'm shaming you. Stop interrupting me. The point, you can't normalize this stuff. The point is, Epstein was running in the top circles, procuring underage girls, little girls, for powerful people, like Bill Gates, maybe. Bill Gates is, it's never been proven that, but Bill Gates was hanging with Jeffrey Epstein. What does Jeffrey Epstein have to offer somebody other than little girls that are 13, 14, 15 years old, which is very illegal? And Bill Clinton? I mean, what if Hillary had won? Epstein would have been pardoned. You realize this, right? If Hillary had won in 16, Epstein would have been pardoned. Whoever killed him, Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself, would have needed to.
You've got...
Corn Pop was a bad dude.
The Michael Berry Show.
Folks, you know, because you listen to my show every day, I don't just tell every guest that you're the most awesome, wonderful, incredible guy ever. So when I do, you know I mean it. Alex Berenson and Chris Rufo are the two guys that I would say in the last 18 months I discovered that I would not have had this world not turned upside down. Rufo on the school issue and Alex Berenson on the COVID issue. It is a real honor to have him on today. He's a former New York Times reporter. He's written 13 novels, 2 nonfiction books, and the Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns series. And today, this very day, his new book hits, Pandemia, How Coronavirus Hysteria Took Over Our Government, Rights, and Our Lives. And I will tell you, this guy has been the foremost expert on getting it out there, challenging the narratives, and it's an honor to have him. Alex, why write this book?
because I think, you know, I've written a lot on Twitter. I now have what's called a Substack, which is sort of a newsletter platform, since Twitter has now banned me for, you know, basically in my mind, for being too accurate about a lot of things. A book is something that lasts. A book is something that people can show their kids, that they can read, you know, they can read overnight, or they can read and return to 5 years later. And, you know, what has happened and what is happening with the coronavirus is so large and so important, both because, you know, of the coronavirus itself and because of these larger societal changes that it is both highlighting and accelerating, that I think a book matters. And I think, a physical book matters, something that people can have, that no matter how much censorship there is, no matter what Twitter or Facebook or Amazon does, you have this physical, book that cannot be taken from you. So I wanted to write a book, and frankly, writing the book, the process of writing the book was really good for me as a reporter, because it allowed me to sort of step back and say, here's what's going on. Here's the last 2 years. Here's all the lies and all the mistakes and all the errors and all the misjudgments that have been made that no one has paid any price for. You know, that Anthony Fauci, has paid no price for all the, incorrect statements he's made, that, that Neil Ferguson, who's a mm-hmm. modeler in the UK, whose predictions helped, foment the panic last March 2020, and it proved totally wrong, how he's paid no price, how we're just bumbling on. And, you see it now with this new variant that the powers that be are trying to scare people with, even though they have no idea if it's actually more dangerous, the same danger or less dangerous than the Delta variant.
The book is Pandemia, How Coronavirus Hysteria Took Over Our Government, Rights, and Lives. You know, Alex, there would be hysteria if fire broke out in a crowded theater, and it would be for good reason. But what troubles me about this, and I want to get you to speak to, is that in many cases, the hysteria was out of proportion to the real risk, and the actions taken were unrelated to actually a scientific approach to solving this problem. Speak to that, if you would.
Yes, I mean, that's quite correct. And so, there was this narrative that came out in January and February of 2020. There were these frightening videos that came out of China, which frankly now appear to be entirely fake or mostly fake. There was this notion that the virus might kill as many as 1 in 25 of the people who got it. None of those things were remotely true. And yet, as new information came in, and it didn't take a year for the new information to come in. By April, certainly by late April, anybody who was following the data could see that the coronavirus just wasn't that dangerous to most people who got it. Not that, again, if it gets into a nursing home, it can do a lot of damage. If it's in hospitals, it can do a lot of damage. If you're morbidly obese, it can certainly kill you if you're unlucky. But most people, it's not that much more than a cold. And maybe it's a flu, but it's not, for most people, it isn't life and death. And there was just this effort to ramp up the hysteria and to scare a lot of people who are at low risk from this, which is exactly the opposite of what, had been the public health playbook during HIV and AIDS, and what, in general, you shouldn't scare people unnecessarily. I think that's a fair, that's a fair thing to say. And yet we went the other way.
You were a very respected New York Times reporter, and, I'll make all the jokes in the world about the left-leaning New York Times, but there was a time that institution was the high water mark of journalism. I know that you've had comments about their coverage and particularly why they got things wrong. How disappointing was that to you, considering that's on your resume and that's something you once considered sacred?
It's disappointing to me. It's not totally surprising, unfortunately, given what we've seen from the Times in the last 5 years. I mean, I think Donald Trump drove a lot of the center left and left media crazy. They couldn't believe he'd been elected. It offended them. And they just sort of decided whatever we need to do to get him out, we're going to do. You know, one of the things that the Times did in the last 2 years, it actually has nothing to do with me or the coronavirus, they secretly edited something that they had published that was very high profile about something called the 1619 Project. They made edits, important edits to this, and didn't disclose that on the internet. So in other words, the internet, you can go back, obviously, and change a story, and nobody knows. It's not, you know, you can do that frictionlessly if you want. But if you're the New York Times, you should never do that. Once you print it, it's the record. And if you're going to change it, you need to acknowledge that. And it was stunning to me that the Times had slipped that far, that was considered okay. I am disappointed in the New York Times. When I was a reporter in Iraq for the Times, which, you know, I was not one of their long-term foreign correspondents, but I was in Iraq in 2003 and 2004 for the New York Times. I'm not exaggerating. I put my life on the line for the New York Times. And so because I consider that, you know, the duty and the privilege of getting to report on, you know, the United States at war for this newspaper to be a sacred thing. And if it meant me taking personal risk, then I had to do that. That's how much the New York Times meant to me. And now it's unrecognizable to me.
Michael Berry Show.
Happy New Year 2020, drone strike hit Soleimani, CDC says something sketchy in Wuhan, China. Iran downs a Ukraine plane, Meghan Markle, Prince Harry abandon the royal family, Astros cheating scandal. Trump gets impeached, no biggie, airlines vegan, COVID screening, a 35-year-old man's the first with a virus from Wuhan, Kobe Bryant's bad at landing, Billie Eilish sweeps the Grammys, WHO declares coronavirus is a scare.
We start the virus, it's from Wuhan, China, we were doing fine until we politicized the virus. Now we're stuck with leaders who are afraid to lead us.
Trump bans Chinese travel in Britain, Brexit's once again. Kansas City Chiefs defeat the Niners in the bowl. Buttigieg wins Iowa, Nancy up and tears it up. The Senate acquits Trump, no duh, impeachment was a show. State of the Union speech, Diamond Princess quarantine. Vindman gets his walking papers, Parasite wins Best Picture. Bernie Sanders building steam, Coors has a mass shooting. Biden smokes Carolina, first official death from China.
Start the virus, it's from Wuhan, China, we were doing fine until we politicized the virus. Now we're stuck with leaders who are afraid to lead us.
Peace with the Taliban, everybody drops but Sanders, Chris Matthews, Vincent Dew, Biden rolls on Super Tuesday, no one left in Italy, Weinstein guilty, Dow Jones submarines, Trump declares emergency. Breonna Taylor shot and killed by the cops in Louisville. Spain says no mas. Thousands die because De Blasio and Cuomo say that old folks gotta stay in nursing homes. Tom Brady leaves the Patriots, postponed tax day.
We didn't start the virus, it's from Wuhan, China. We were doing fine until we politicized the virus. Now we're stuck with leaders who are afraid to lead us.
Boris Johnson got infected, USNS Comfort. Bernie ends his foolish plight, making way for Joseph Biden. IRS is pumping dough, Bengals pick Joe Burrow. Venezuela coup aborted, Tesla's leaving California. George Floyd can't breathe, was it the Rona or the knee? Ray Brooks fights cops in a Wendy's parking lot.
We didn't start the virus, it's from Wuhan, China, we were doing fine until we politicized the virus. Now we're stuck with
the book is Pandemia, How Coronavirus Hysteria Took Over Our Government Rights and Lives. He's Alex Berenson. What was the biggest lie that was told that you think was not something where they stumbled? I mean, nobody said the earth was flat because they had something to gain from it. They just didn't know. Where was the lie told?
That's a great question. The biggest lie. I mean, you know, the biggest lie has been the most basic lie, which is that this virus is a serious risk to everyone. When that is just so clearly not true. This virus clearly it's killed a lot of people. And if, again, if it gets into the wrong environment, it can cause a lot of problems, and it can cause these surges where, you know, the healthcare system can be, you know, temporarily under stress or even close to overwhelmed. But it is not a societal risk. I mean, I will go to the mat for that statement. It is not a risk to society. Everything we've done to combat it is a risk to society. But to pretend that if you're a healthy 20 or 30 or 40 or even 50-year-old that you have much to fear from this is just a lie. Now, again, once in a while, something terrible is going to happen, right? Somebody is going to get this who's otherwise healthy and relatively young, and they're going to die. But that happens with the flu, too, by the way. Occasionally, the flu kills young, healthy people, too. And we don't pretend that it's, you know, that the risk is equal for everybody. So to me, that was sort of the base lie, and they've never corrected it.
I often say we have to understand, whether it's CRT in the schools or closing of the Keystone Pipeline or the vaccine or other COVID hysteria, we have to remember that these things will come and go. But the bigger question is, what's the residue? How have we changed our structure? What does science mean? What does truth mean? And what I find, Alex, most troubling is the death of journalism. I don't hate journalism. I love it. There was a time, I mean, I grew up admiring the Cronkites and the Edward R. Murrows. And the death of journalism, in the sense that the Jeffersonians believed it was important to the functioning of democracy, that's going to be bigger than any outbreak, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, the death of journalism, I would go even further than that. I would say the death of the idea of free speech as a sacred American right. Because we're not just talking about journalism, we're not just talking about legacy media, we're talking about social media companies that are openly saying, you know, Facebook will tell you in advance what you can and can't write about the coronavirus. And, you know, Twitter, the new CEO, the guy who's taking over, has said, you know, we don't really believe in the First Amendment. We believe in healthy public discussion. Well, excuse me, who is setting the parameters of the healthy public discussion? You know, that's not the American way.
It's not the American way, and it's not what makes a great nation. So where do you go forward? What is your focus as this thing continues, and hopefully one day it abates? Where do you go from there? Has this given you a new direction, a new cause, a new mission?
I, you know, at the moment, I'm just still trying to, you know, to report about Corona, and frankly, sorting out the mess, sorting out whether it's, you know, where the coronavirus really came from, or some of the issues around vaccines and, you know, and their safety and how quickly they were moved forward. Those are projects that, you know, I think reporters should be doing for years to come. I mean, I feel a real burden, to be honest with you, about coronavirus, because I feel like I'm the only serious investigative reporter in the United States. Not the only person, okay, but the only person sort of with an investigative reporting background who's asking questions about the vaccines. And again, that's not to say that the vaccines are deadly, or no one should get them. I'm talking about reasonable, basic questions about clinical trial design, about side effects, about what long-term adverse events might look like, about how long they work for. I feel like I'm the only person with reporting chops asking those questions in a serious way. And that's a real, I don't like it, honestly. I wish there were a dozen other people doing this. So for now, I'm focusing on coronavirus. And the vaccine. What happens next, I don't know. But, you know, Pandemia, I don't think will be the last book that I write about the coronavirus.
It's unfortunate because institutions like the New York Times, that used to have 1,000 employees, and the Washington Post, and for that matter, the Atlantic, and these institutions had resources and a loyal base of people who respected journalism. And that meant that when you did good work, it was out there to the crowd. Now there's had to be this entire new construct that rose up to get your work out there. And it's unfortunate, because I'm not going to lament the death of those newspapers, at least what they were, but it's unfortunate because the long-term effects is the next Alex Berenson may not be discovered. He may not get his material out there. Unfortunately, Alex, I'm up against a break. You're doing great work. Keep it up. Alex Berenson, the book is Pandemia, How Coronavirus Hysteria Took Over Our Government, Rights, and Lives. Out today.
It's that time. Time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
Remember when LSU fans won't want to remember this, but you remember when Nick Saban came to Alabama and Alabama hadn't been the powerhouse that it had once been for quite a while. Saban came in that first season. They didn't immediately win the national championship. They lost two games or four games. I can't remember. I just remember that during the next spring, ESPN did a profile on him, and I used to obsessively watch sports back then, but not anymore. And they came in to look at, because Saban had won a national championship with LSU, could he do this with Alabama? Probably not, but it was worth the story. It was worth the hype. And they weren't doing football drills. They were just doing conditioning. And I remember they asked him the question, you're not doing football. There's no passing. There's no running. There's no blocking. All you're doing is conditioning. And he said, we lost, I think it was four games. We lost four games last year. It was his first season, so it wasn't really his team yet. He hadn't recruited these kids. They weren't the kind of kids that are there now. And he said, we lost all four of those in the second half. When you lose games in the second half, it's because of conditioning. We'll never be out-conditioned again. And if you look at how many times Nick Saban wins games in the fourth quarter, it's because his teams are in better shape. Now, they're bigger, faster, stronger, better skill sets, better coached, you name it. But that's the sort of thing that makes a difference. You don't just end up with a team, every one of which, 11 guys on both sides of the ball, are in better shape than your opponent by accident. That doesn't happen. That is a strategy. That is coached. That is motivated. That is drilled. That is executed again and again and again and again. Now, I don't care which team you like. Nobody wins the way Nick Saban does. Nick Saban is not a nice guy. He is the mean tweets of college football. But I will tell you this, every fan out there, no, Ramon, I'm not going to make you run laps after the show, but that's actually not a bad idea. Ramon thought that's where I was going with that. This probably wouldn't be a bad idea, although you've lost weight during the week. What are you down? Are you down under 200? Ramon gets a little Christmas bonus if he gets under 200 by Christmas. Dude, you're going to be a funny-looking dude because your head is – you still have a big head, and you're going to have that little bit of skinny body underneath it. It's going to be so weird. You're going to look like a lollipop. You know who you're going to look like, although he doesn't have a big head? My buddy Ray Sienkiewicz, who turns 58 today. Happy birthday to Ray Sienkiewicz, if you know Ray. Ray is down 75 pounds. 75 pounds. Some of you will remember Ray as the guy who, when Ramon lost his first 100, Ray said to me outside Ramon's hearing, you know he'll put that back on. And I told Ramon that as motivation. And then I said it on the air. And now Ray gets he gets ripped over that constantly. And it was all meant in good fun. But anyway. Nick Saban wins year in, year out, year in, year out, and there's not a college football fan in the country, despite what they may say, who wouldn't give everything they have for that guy to come and coach their team. There are rumors that he's going to LSU. I don't believe it. Lincoln Riley, Cliff Kingsbury, Sarkisian, even Lane Kiffin, of course Coach O, who I love, but he's not the coach Saban is, Jimbo even. None of these guys, none of them, or Nick Saban. Spurrier wasn't. It really doesn't matter. What was the wide right guy at Florida State forever? His son coached as well. You know what I'm talking about. Bobby Bowden. None of these guys are Nick Saban. If Nick Saban was in politics, he couldn't coach the and we voted on who would coach Alabama. Nick Saban wouldn't coach Alabama because he's mean. There was a college, I can't remember what the dang thing is called, college reform. Maybe it's college reform. Years ago, they went on a university campus, and they started asking people about affirmative action in politics. And then they asked him about affirmative action in sports without using that phrase. Interestingly, people want the best point guard, best low post, best forward, best basketball team on the court that's the team they root for. They want the best quarterback, running back, wide receivers, O-line, D-line, linebackers, defensive backs, coaches. They want the best for their NFL team or their college team. But when it comes to politics, we don't need the best. We need whatever I am also. Asian sports fans don't say, I won't root for that team unless they have an Asian quarterback. But that's what people will do, isn't it? Gay sports fans, if there are any, don't say, I'm not going to root for that team unless they have a gay quarterback. Well, you got Tom Brady and that's it. So what are you going to do? I mean, what are the other teams in the league going to do? Bill Belichick gets a bad rap for being a grump because people want him to be nice at the post-game press conference. All Bill Belichick does is win. And if you felt yourself going, we hadn't won without Brady, Bill Belichick's the winningest football coach in the last 25 years. And 25 years from now, you can stretch that period of time. There still won't be anybody that's won the way he has. What he did was unprecedented. Because guess what? He is a grump. And he's the mean tweets of NFL coaches. And if you want to win, you go get the mean tweets of whatever field you're in. Guys that are good are not nice. They're winners. Belichick's a winner. Nick Saban's a winner. Donald Trump's a winner. If you want Wayne Fonts as your coach, fine. Or who was that? Was it Charlie Strong? Who was a black dude that came from Louisville that I had to hear how good he was going to be? And he was part of UT's long run of mediocrity. Charlie Strong wasn't bad. He just wasn't good. There's a lot of those guys. There's a lot of guys that are put in the NFL because or college ranks because they're black or Hispanic or they play the game. There's a lot of guys that play the game, but they're not winners. And people can understand that you want a winner on the sporting field, but they can't seem to understand that the difference between a winner as president, a winner as cabinet officials, a winner as school teachers and principals is just as important, in fact, far more so than as being a nice guy or checking the right box. Nobody says we have to have a woman at quarterback, we have to have equality or equity. No, you don't do that. And guess what? Nobody ever argued that an NFL player who's black is there because they're black. Nobody ever said, well, Tony Dorsett, I'm not even sure he was that good. I think he was just there because he was black. He was an affirmative action hire, right? Nobody said that of Doug Williams, his black quarterback. Am I dating myself? I once paid attention to sports. Now, the kneeling. You get the point, though. You get the point. So Chance and I are working on a bit together, and I called him while I was driving in this morning to go over some ideas, and I'm trying to remember why this came up, but he said, you know, our generation was supposedly so homophobic. The next generation thinks that our generation was very homophobic, right? Which, by the way, you're allowed to not like gays or blacks or whites or old people or Asians or fat people. this idea that you don't get to choose who and what you like or don't like is ridiculous. It's just dumb. You're allowed to have your prejudices. And even legally, you're allowed to have your prejudices. You're just not allowed to discriminate, which is to treat two like things dissimilarly. There is a difference, but that's not the point I was going to make. He said, you know, these young kids today, the woke college kids, want to act like we were such bad people because we were so homophobic. He said, you think about this. Boy George came on the radio and nobody blinked. That dude was dressed in full-on makeup. There was no doubting. When you found out 5 years ago that he took some dude hostage and sexually tormented him for weeks on end, you didn't go, no, not Boy George. He wouldn't do that. You said, yeah, sure he did. And probably sang Karma Chameleon the whole time, just on loop, probably did. You would expect that, right? He's Jamie Gumm in Silence of the Lambs, and you don't even think about it. But nobody was bothered, right? Nobody said, ah, don't listen to that. I don't care what colors your dreams are. You get off the radio, you homo. Nobody ever did that. Seriously, he suffered nothing. George Michael? Is it Michael or Michaels? Freddie Mercury? They named the band Queen. I mean, could you try any harder? And the point was that for as awful as we are supposed to be, so he made this point. He said, there were all these guys that were very gay and nobody cared because they were good artists. Nobody cared. The art was more important. I said, you know, you're right. And then he started going through TV shows. He said, think about it. We had Too Close for Comfort. We had, remember Joe on The Facts of Life, the lesbian girl, and they would dress her up. They would doll her up like she was a straight girl, remember? I mean, they were telling you, she's straight up lesbian. Miss Garrett was trying to turn her. And who was your favorite on that show? I like that little tootie. You like Joe? Of course you did. You like... Anyway, please don't distract me. So back to the point. So he's rattling off these characters that were homo, and we didn't care. Like, nobody said, I'm not watching that because they have a homo. Nobody cared. And he's rattling them off, and then he said, Monroe. And he went, and I said, well, I hated Monroe. Don't you remember Monroe? The real Nelly dude that was, you don't remember Monroe? I can't remember the name of the TV show, but Monroe was the guy that was on there. I hate that actor. I hate everything he's in. He's just real annoying. He's real prissy. You know what I'm talking about? Was that, yeah, I guess it was Too Close for Comfort. Yeah. Do you remember yeah, that's Monroe. Monroe was annoying. But a lot of gay characters back then were all really silly, annoying, you know, what do they call them? Hags with English cigarettes. I don't know if we can say that one. I can't remember if that one's blocked or not. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. But I didn't actually like Monroe. Did you? You're not old enough to remember that show. Yeah, I didn't either. I didn't either. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. It was a very, very good point that as bad as we were supposed to be and as racist as we were supposed to be, the entire nation, you think about the shows of our childhood. They were already beginning the social engineering. We were very comfortable with black kids that were taken in by a rich old white man. And the kids were the star. Mr. Drummond wasn't. Think about that. It started in the 70s, but the transition over that period from when Sidney Poitier kisses a white woman on air. Was it Postman Rings Twice? When Bill Cosby appears in I Spy, Three's Company. Two girls and one guy. Nobody thought he... Do you remember the guy that they replaced John Ritter with? He just couldn't hold up. You don't remember? He had black, frizzy hair. Was that Larry? Oh, that was... No. But they came in later with the John Ritter replacement. Yeah, they did. You don't... I'm telling you. They replaced John Ritter. At one point, they had like a blonde dude. Yeah, they did. I'm telling you. They had... See, now we're wasting people's time on something that's stupid because you won't quit.
Houston man sentenced to more than 9 years in prison for getting nearly $1.6 million in PPP loans. He spent the cash on a Lamborghini, a Ford F-350, a Rolex watch, and, of course, strip clubs.
This guy got over $1 million in PPP loans. That's $1 million that could have gone to needing eligible small businesses.
Tax expert Randall Jones says he has small business owners for clients who weren't so lucky when it came to being approved for PPP loan funds. Meanwhile, federal investigators say 1.6 million of the government's available PPP funds went to Lee Price here in Houston.
The key requirement for getting a PPP loan is that you have employees. It can be yourself, or it can be others, or it can be yourself and others.
Investigators say Price was approved for $900,000 on one loan application and approved for another $700,000 on a second loan application using another business. Price reportedly claimed to have numerous employees and hefty payroll expenses. However, according to charging documents, neither businesses Price used in his applications have any employees at all.
For someone to fraudulently do that, they would have to produce fraudulent payroll records. What I mean by that is 941 reports and W-2s and W-3s.
The loan is intended to help businesses who have been negatively impacted during the pandemic survive.
What you do is you sign off that you're going to use the funds from that loan to continue to pay your employees and to continue to pay yourself so that your business can stay open.
What federal investigators say Price did instead was make lavish purchases, including a Lamborghini, a brand new truck, a Rolex watch, and real estate transactions. Price is also accused of blowing thousands at strip clubs and Houston nightclubs.
At some point, falsified payroll records are going to be verified or be able to be verified by the IRS.
Jones says falsifying this information will be hard to get away with, even if you are approved seemingly fast and easily. Price is now charged for making false statements to a financial institution, wire fraud, bank fraud, and engaging in unlawful monetary transactions. He received a total of $1.6 million.
A lot of small businesses were left holding the bag. They didn't get their PPP loans because people like this were out fraudulently, beating the system.
You realize how many people did that? And the thing about it is, a guy like that can't help himself. A guy like that, if he gets some money, you look at these guys, you look at people that win the lottery, they're back broke in a year because they're stupid. They're broke in the first place because they're stupid. You give them a bunch of money, they're going to be broke again. Because their idea of having money is going out and buying sports cars, exotic cars, going to strip clubs, buying expensive watches. They're not the millionaire next door. This guy could have squirreled this money away and nobody would have ever known. But that's why he wants money. He doesn't want money to invest it. He doesn't want money for the security over the long term for his retirement. He wants money to...
The Michael Berry Show.
Please clap. Please clap.
Terrence K. Williams is our guest. I was asked by him and his team if I would support a show he's doing in Houston on December 4th, Saturday, this Saturday, at the Cullen Performance Hall, and I said gladly. I love what he's doing. Terrence K. Williams, welcome to the show, bud.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's going to be a big night Saturday. Steve Mudflap McGrew, I'll play some of his comedy for y'all later in the show if you haven't heard him. He's very, very funny, is opening. Our friend Chingo Bling is hosting, and Terrence K. Williams will be making folks laugh for the evening. This Saturday, there are some tickets remaining. It's at Cullen Performance Hall, which is a beautiful, beautiful space. Well done on that. What is the message you want people to take away? I know you make people laugh, but you have a pretty inspiring message, Terrence.
Yeah, at my show, of course, it's all about laughing and having a great time. And also, I love my country, man. I love America. And this country right now, we are in trouble under this administration right now. I mean, people are divided like never before. And I want to bring people together, man, you know, so laughing and bringing people together and showing people that this is the greatest country in the world and we should put our country first and we should respect our country, and we should respect each other, because right now, man, we're so divided right now. You know, Republican versus Democrat, liberal versus conservative, you know, but really it's evil versus good.
You know, and, I have said for years, Terrence, and I've made it much more of a focus the last couple of years to support conservative comics, because we lose particularly young people. When you make someone, and most comics are liberal, when you make someone laugh, you have an opportunity to open their mind and fill it, to engage them, to challenge them. And it's a very, very powerful tool. And all too often on our side, we're better at pounding the table and gritting our teeth and being angry and screaming, where laughter can bring in a whole new demographic. It's sort of what Joe Rogan has done for the spoken word, for, you know, political commentary. I think you can do that with comedy. Do you find certain elements of your show are resonating today that maybe didn't before? Certain things people want to hear?
I think a lot of people just want to hear the truth, you know? Like, people just want to hear, you know, people want to hear something positive, and just also the truth, because a lot of the comics and a lot of the entertainers in Hollywood, they get on stage and they bash America. They bash conservatives. They bash white people all the time. You know, and it's all about race this and race that. So I think a lot of people just want to hear somebody in the entertainment world who loves America. Like, you know, like, because if you watch Netflix, if you watch all these TV shows, if you go to comedy shows, or if you go to concerts, people are still, you know, pushing their agenda on people. And people are getting sick of that crap. They're getting sick of it. They're getting sick of going out to places and hearing people talk crazy about this country and disrespect our veterans and our police officers. People get tired of that. So I think a lot of people just want to get a good laugh and also hear a real message and just be reminded that, you know, that there are people out here in this country who are still patriotic. And I think people love seeing that. They just love that. I think that's just the best thing ever.
You know, you came to my attention when Trump made such a big deal of you, but I've seen you on Greg Gutfeld's show. I've seen you now. I've gone to YouTube and followed you for a while, and I follow you on Twitter. To me, the most inspiring part of your story is having grown up in foster care, having grown up within the system, having had a difficult childhood, how you managed out of that to have such a positive approach. And I think everybody, regardless your upbringing, regardless your race, regardless your status, how much you had or didn't have, or whether mommy and daddy loved you or not, I think that's a very inspirational message. It's important to laugh, but underneath that, you've got a real message.
Yeah, and you know what? That's something else that I also talk about at my show. There's not one show I don't talk about me growing up in foster care. I share that story because I want to inspire people and motivate people and also remind people that the American dream is real, and that also that God is good, because that's the only reason why I made it, you know, out of foster care in my right mind, because of God. My mother had 9 children. She was addicted to drugs, and she was just unable to take care of us. And we were in and out of the system, bouncing from foster home to foster home. I lived in children's shelters. I mean, I've been through it all, and God was there with me, and he got me through all of that. And since I live in the greatest country in the world, regardless of me going through all of that trauma and all of that pain and all of that hurt, not being able to be with my family and going through the system, regardless of all of that, I was still able to chase my dreams. I was still able to become the person that I wanted to become. And look at me. I was able to go from the foster house and meet the president of the United States of America, from the foster house to the White House, and sat with President Donald J. Trump. Like, that's something that I never even imagined when I was in foster care. I wasn't thinking about a White House. I was thinking about whose house I could go to and have a good meal, whose house I can go to and feel loved and be loved. I wouldn't think about no White House. And I made it through, and I made it from the foster house all the way to the White House. That's a blessing, and I want to and I want to share that message with the world. And I could have made all kinds of excuses and blame the government and blame America and blame the white man, blame that person and this person, but I decided to just, you know, move on and put God first and chase my dreams, man, because that's what America is all about.
I love
you know,
it.
And get, listen, and I'm black too, of course, everybody know that, but, and you know what, and me being black did not stop me from me from going from the foster house to the White House. Like, if I can do it, anybody in this country can do it, you know?
I love it. Terrence K. Williams, I'm up against a break. He'll be at the University of Houston Cullen Performance Hall, a beautiful, beautiful space, this Saturday at 8 p.m. You can get your tickets, still available. There's a VIP meet and greet as well as general admission tickets. Just look up Terrence, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E, Terrence K. Williams. You'll go to his website, and it'll show you the Laugh at Your Own Risk tour. Steve Mudflap McGrew is opening, and he's very funny. His tour is the White Privilege Tour, but white is marked out. It's the What Privilege Tour. And our good friend Chingo Bling is hosting of Vamos Brandon fame, and he's very funny as well. It's going to be a good time this Saturday night. Get your tickets.
Let's hear what you got.
The Michael Barry Show.
I've read a lot of Orwell, Huxley, Bradbury, Heinlein. One of the things that comes through is in all of these sort of dystopian warnings of government gone wrong, tyrannical control, authoritarianism, is the idea of truth and who owns it, who controls it. And that, with that in mind, the idea that Twitter and Facebook, these rogue operations of tyrannical superpowers that have affected our elections, the idea that they would have quote-unquote fact checkers to prevent misinformation when they are actually misinformation manipulators, I mean, this really is Nazi Germany-level stuff. It really is. And John Stossel has the story.
I've reported that Facebook censored me. Now I've learned that Facebook also censors a bunch of people who report on science.
Please welcome Michael Schellenberger.
People like an environmentalist who Time magazine listed among heroes of the environment. That's Michael Schellenberger.
You're going to need a lot more clean energy.
Facebook also censors.
There's a man named one of the world's most influential people of the 21st century.
That's statistician and environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg. And they censor science writer and
New York Times contributing columnist John Tierney.
They accuse all of us of spreading misinformation. But really,
the people guilty of spreading misinformation are Facebook and its fact checkers.
To do the fact checking, Facebook partners with groups like these. All of them approved by something called the Poynter Institute. It calls itself a global leader in journalism and claims it has
a commitment to nonpartisanship and fairness.
But they're hardly nonpartisan. Just look at their website, their eagerness to honor left-leaning reporters, and their push to decolonize the media and change language shows their leftist bias. Poynter once even apologized after it tried to blacklist conservative news sites. Yet absurdly, this is who Facebook partners with to certify who will censor all of us. One so-called fact-checker Poynter approved is this group, Science Feedback, run by this man who says his censors will cleanse the internet.
Tous vos enfants pourront surfer en toute tranquillité sur des vagues d'informations crédibles.
He's the censor-in-chief. His group objected to this article John Tierney wrote that said masking children can be harmful.
More than 10,000 parents said that masks were giving their kids headaches, making it harder for them to concentrate.
Tierney simply cited a study, which later passed peer review, that said masks sometimes cause problems.
Everything I wrote was accurate, and yet they labeled it partly false.
They said the study he cited wasn't good enough because it's not a random sample. Parents' comments may not be representative of the general population. But Tierney had acknowledged that.
It's obviously not a random sample.
You said that.
I said that in the piece.
They censored him anyway. This partly false label is nasty because it leads Facebook to stop showing Tierney's work to many people. What should be labeled false is science feedback's sloppy fact check.
The worst misinformation is what the fact checkers are spreading. They've got this key takeaway that masks are fine for children over 2 years old. That's not something that most scientists believe. It's not what the World Health Organization believes.
No, the World Health Organization says kids under five should not be required to wear masks. The so-called fact checkers ignore that and don't cite any studies to support their opinion on mask safety.
Meanwhile, I'm citing peer-reviewed scientific studies that have demonstrated something called mask-induced exhaustion syndrome. There are all kinds of well-documented effects of wearing masks.
You're not saying nobody should wear a mask or that masks are useless.
No, but we should acknowledge that masks do have impacts. You know, workers who wear masks for a couple hours in Germany, they have to stop and take a half-hour break after that. I mean, this shouldn't be a controversial thing to say.
No, but Facebook generally bans it because science feedback doesn't want it said.
They don't want anyone presenting evidence that goes against their desire to tell people what to do.
Just wear a mask. I shouldn't have to make it fun. It's science.
They don't want people to see contrary evidence.
We know that it's been debunked that this virus was man-made.
Another example. Poynter Institute's Thought Police declared that the COVID lab leak idea was incorrect. Science feedback still insists COVID is of natural origin. Facebook eventually banned even discussing whether it might have been man-made until the very day the Biden administration admitted
COVID may have been accidentally leaked from a Chinese lab.
Only then did Facebook lift its ban.
You're not like a tree hugger kind of guy, right?
I am sort of a tree hugger.
Global warming's another subject science feedback does not want people to see certain information about. Michael Schellenberger was censored after he wrote that climate change won't bring an apocalypse.
They censored me for saying that we're not in a sixth mass extinction. We're not.
Climate feedback justified their censorship by citing this report that claims we are pushing the planet toward a mass extinction. But a chair of that group told Schellenberger, we're not in a mass extinction. We don't say that.
You have to have 50 to 75% of all species on Earth going extinct to be in a mass extinction.
They also censor Bjorn Lomborg for saying,
turns out that when temperatures rise, you're going to see more heat deaths, but many fewer cold deaths. So overall, the rising temperatures have actually saved lives.
Now, it hasn't been proven that the cause of the drop in deaths is the temperature rise. Could have been something else. But so what? His main point that temperature-related deaths fell while the planet warmed is true and important. Yet science feedback keeps that out of your Facebook feed.
The points that I try to make are the points you don't normally hear, and that's what they hate.
Why do they want to do this?
There's a lot of folks who are very emotionally invested in the climate catastrophe argument. Partly, it makes it a lot easier to get people to donate money and to accept that politicians are spending their tax dollars on climate policy if it's the end of the world.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction.
They have a mission outside just facts. They also want you to not know stuff. That's not fact check. That's simply saying we don't want to hear this opinion in the public space. And quite frankly, that's terrifying.
Il nous faut des centaines de milliers potentiellement.
Now science feedback's leader says he wants to expand, to censor not just Facebook, but other social media. That makes me scared.
It certainly makes me scared when you look at their track record so far. The goal is nice, that we actually try to make sure we have less misinformation on the internet. But you could very well end up in a place where we only have the approved facts that fit the current narrative. That would be a terrible outcome.
Science feedback so-called fact checkers go well beyond checking facts.
They're trying to suppress people whose opinions and whose evidence they don't like. They're not fact checkers, they're fact blockers.
The world doesn't need fact blockers. We need more freedom to speak, not less. Facebook's Poynter Institute censors are now the enemy of open debate.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. Thank you and good night.